Well, tomorrow is Halloween, as you probably all know. After the sun goes down, children and adults are going to spill out onto the streets everywhere, dressed as goblins and ghosts and devils and monsters. It's really a strange ritual when you think about it, right? But it actually dates back to the Celtic people and others who believed and have believed for a very long time that on Halloween night, the world of the living and the world of the dead become so closely aligned that one can reach into the other. Somehow, by dressing in frightening garments, we are able to boldly confront the terrors of the night and even mock the powers of darkness. That's why we wear those costumes. Well, we're also taking on monsters and trolls in our fall message series called Defeating Giants. We're learning how to take down those intimidating opponents who come into our lives to try to bother, scare, or hurt us. You know, it could be like a bully in your life somewhere, or another giant might be a frightening health issue that you're dealing with right now. It could be the loss of a relationship, or the death of a loved one, or some other fear or trauma that you have. Giants are always trying to scare, bother, and hurt us. But fortunately, the Bible is filled with stories about underdogs and misfits who have prevailed over these and other terrible giants. And what we're learning is that in every case, the underdog did not try to battle the giant on its own terms. That would be a recipe for disaster. The giant is always going to be bigger, stronger, and more powerful. No, the winning strategy for every underdog in the Bible seems to be relying on their own hidden strengths, uniquely given to them by God. Just think about David and Goliath, for instance, right? When Goliath came out on that battlefield, he was expecting to encounter another big, strong, giant warrior like himself. But he ended up a sitting duck for a simple rock shot by a young boy from a slingshot. It's the same with all the underdog stories. In the first week of the series. Remember this? 2 weeks ago, we learned about a poor widow up against a powerful judge, and the widow was clearly the underdog. Well, the judge expected her to give up bothering him about what she needed, but she ended up winning through her hidden strength, perseverance. And then last week, we heard about an arrogant religious leader who expected God to choose him over a sinful tax collector. But the tax collector won God's favor instead because of his humility. He saw himself for who he really was and didn't try to pretend he was something that he wasn't. That's another hidden strength. You know, the same thing happened to me actually recently. A few months ago, Archbishop Corleone asked me to preach at the annual Red Mass for members of the legal profession. If you don't know what that is, every year around the world, especially in places like Washington, D.C., the bishop there will celebrate a Red Mass to pray for the members of the judiciary, judges and lawyers, as they begin the new legal year. And so we have a Red Mass every year here in San Francisco, and the Archbishop asked me to preach at the upcoming one. Here's how he invited me. I think it's hysterical. He was here for something else, and he spent the night in the rectory, and then the next morning, we're talking in my room, and he says, Roger, yeah, we're on a first-name basis. He calls me Roger. I call him Your Excellency. Anyway, then he said, you know, Roger, every year we invite a nationally recognized speaker or a distinguished scholar of the law to deliver the homily at the Red Mass. And I'm thinking, all right, Archbishop, I know where you're going with this, right? And he says, but No one's available this year, so would you like to do it? One of the many things I love about our Archbishop is he's a very honest man. Anyway, of course, I said yes, but I have to tell you, the weight of that hung over me like a huge giant sitting on my chest. For months, I was worried about it. I mean, I'm just, you know, a parish priest. I happen to have a law degree from a long time ago, but what could I say to these, you know, distinguished members of the judiciary? I mean, there are California Supreme Court justices there at this thing, and what am I going to say? So I agonized over the homily for a long time. You know, and at first I said, you know, I'm going to go down to USF, I'm going to go to the law library, I'm going to read all these legal journals and history books to try to figure out some nugget of wisdom that I could convey to this distinguished group of Catholic judges and lawyers. But finally, I gave up because it was useless. My legal skills were rusty. I'd never be able to read and understand the complex legal articles without more practice. And that would take time, time that I did not have. And so I eventually ran out of time. And I just decided to be myself. Just to be myself and give the homily the way I always do, like I do with you. So I'm standing there at the pulpit. You can see it there. Really intimidating backdrop there at the St. Peter and Paul Church in North Beach. And the Archbishop, of course, is sitting right there. So I'm standing there at the pulpit. I'm really nervous. And I told the congregation, with the Archbishop sitting right there, I told them that the legal profession had become one of the least respected institutions in America over the last 40 years. I know, uh-oh, right? Now, my assertion was based on statistics. I mean, it's based on public opinion polls about the Supreme Court and the judiciary. But I could only imagine how that might have gone over. And then I told these Catholic judges and lawyers, I said, you know what, even with a tarnished public image that you have, you need to go back into burning Rome, just like St. Peter did 2,000 years ago, and work to uphold the rule of law, even when it seems like everyone is against you. That was my message. That's it. Well, I finally finished and went back to my chair, certain that I had angered or at least bored them. But then, at the sign of peace during the Mass, the Archbishop embraced me, and he whispered into my ear, "Well done." And it was like this huge giant coming off my chest. And then at the dinner later that night, I received many compliments. I know that doesn't sound very humble to be talking about, but the point I'm trying to make is that that scary giant ended up not being so scary after all, because I did not pretend to be somebody I wasn't. And I just worked with the rather meager talents that God gave me. The point is, humility can take down a lot of giants. But what if being yourself is not quite enough? What if you're not quite ready for prime time? What if you've swallowed your pride and you've tried to kill that giant with kindness or with some other act of humility and it didn't work? What do you do then? Well, let's turn to the gospel passage for this week to see if we can learn from a story about how one man humbled himself, but then took an extra step and was transformed from a misfit into a hero for God. Here's how the story begins. Jesus came to Jericho, and he intended to pass through the town. Now, that was the way you would get to Jerusalem from beyond the Jordan, as you would go through Jericho and then up to Jerusalem. Now, here's what you need to know about Jericho. It's widely regarded as the oldest city in the world, dating back to about 9,000 BC. It's also the first city that the Israelites settled when they arrived in the Promised Land after their escape from Egypt. It's located about 15 miles east of Jerusalem near the Jordan River, which made it a major trade thoroughfare. People, merchants, would travel through there. And it also had a very temperate climate, beautiful palm trees, and several freshwater springs. And that made it an attractive getaway for the rich and the famous of the time. Think about, you know, city people going to Healdsburg, kind of the way Jericho was back then. King Herod, for instance, built his winter palace there. It also attracted a large population of priests. So Jericho was the place to encounter the spiritual and political elite of that time. Now, a man named Zacchaeus was definitely not a member of the spiritual and political elite. In fact, he was pretty much despised because he was a chief tax collector and a wealthy man. You see, tax collectors were despised in those days. They were Jews who assessed taxes on behalf of Rome and therefore were considered traitors. They also often cheated the people by collecting more than what was required and then keeping the extra for themselves. There was only one reason to be a tax collector back then: to become rich. Being the chief tax collector in the area, Zacchaeus was certainly wealthy and probably despised all the more. But then the story takes a funny turn. Zacchaeus could not see Jesus because of the crowd, for he was short in stature. So he ran ahead and he climbed a sycamore tree to see Jesus pass by. Now here, the gospel writer Luke is clearly poking fun at Zacchaeus. Not only was Zacchaeus, you know, vertically challenged, but he also acted like a fool, right? It was considered beneath the dignity of grown men in those days to run because they were wearing long robes. I mean, you'd probably fall on your face or something. And it was unheard of to climb trees like little children. No one would do that. But Zacchaeus did both. Luke is painting him as a kind of a buffoon. He's doing it to entertain his readers and to surprise them, because no one would have expected what happened next. When he reached the place, Jesus looked up and said, "Zacchaeus, come down, for today I must stay at your house." This was not a chance encounter. Jesus specifically looked up to find Zacchaeus. He called him by name and he said, "I must stay at your house." The Greek verb there for must is used in Luke to convey divine necessity. It's something Jesus had to do to fulfill God's plan. So Zacchaeus comes down from the tree and he accepts Jesus' invitation. But then the crowd begins to grumble, saying, "Oh, he's gone to stay at the house of a sinner." Well, put yourself in their position, right? The well-heeled of Jericho were shocked. I mean, among the crowd must have been many priests and royal figures, well-connected people and members of the upper classes. That's who lived in Jericho. And they must have wondered why Zacchaeus was selected. Of all the affluent homes to which Jesus could have invited himself, why did he go to the residence of a most unfavored person like Zacchaeus? Well, the answer comes next. Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, "I'm going to give away half of my wealth to the poor. And if I've cheated anyone, I'm going to pay them back four times over, much more than what the Bible required." In other words, Zacchaeus resolved to change his life. And so Jesus says, in one of the most beautiful lines of the Bible, "Salvation has come to this house, for the Son of Man has come to seek and to save what was lost." So beautiful. You know, Zacchaeus was persistent, like the widow in her fight against the judge, right? Even though the odds were against him, Zacchaeus went to great lengths to see Jesus. Zacchaeus was also humble, like the tax collector in last week's story. Zacchaeus wasn't afraid to make a fool of himself in order to get the attention of Jesus. But Zacchaeus had one other thing going for him, and this is what got the attention of Jesus over all the other important people in Jericho. Zacchaeus was willing to change his life. And not in some small way, but in a meaningful and deliberate way. The change that Zacchaeus needed to make was to shed his excess wealth. That's what was holding him back from the life that God wanted for him. You know, when it comes to money, more is not always better. We all know this deep down, I hope, but it's simply not true that more money will make you happier. Scholars who research happiness have shown that more money stops making people happier at a surprisingly low point. Beyond that point, the nicer cars, bigger houses, and more expensive pleasures don't make people happier or more fulfilled. I think about my older brother, Kerry. He's kind of a good example of this. He told me when we were kids that he was going to be a millionaire by the time he was 35. $1 million was a lot back then. For years, he worked his fingers to the bone. He moved to New York City, worked endless hours. He made some money, but he wasn't happy. When he was in his early 40s, he changed his life, kind of like Zacchaeus. He never cheated anyone, but he just decided it wasn't worth it. And he moved to a small town in Florida. He downsized his business, and now he chooses to work only for nonprofit organizations and small churches. He doesn't make a lot of money. He'll never be a millionaire, but he's happy. We always assume that being bigger and stronger and richer is the way to win at life. But the very thing that we think is advantageous sometimes is precisely the obstacle that holds us back. For Zacchaeus, it was greed that held him back. For you, for me, it might be something different that we need to change. Maybe it's resolving the anger and frustration that you feel over the little things every day. That's me. Maybe you have a teacher or a boss who rubs you the wrong way and you just need to deal with it. Or perhaps you tend to take shortcuts, or you're prone to distractions, or maybe you exaggerate or lie just a little bit to get people's attention and make them think you're smarter or more interesting than you really are. Or maybe you need to forgive someone and let go of resentment. I believe God is speaking to you right now and to me about something that we all need to change in our life and possibly make amends for, like Zacchaeus. And so I invite you to take some time now in church to reflect on that. Sin is our worst enemy because it blocks God's power in our struggle against the giants who are trying to take us down. One last thing. You know, there's a really interesting thing about that passage with Zacchaeus. He promises to make amends, but the Greek phrasing in there, oddly, is in the present tense, not the future tense, which suggests that Zacchaeus may have already started giving to the poor and paying back his ill-gotten gains before he ever met Jesus. And maybe, like Zacchaeus, you have started trying to make small changes in your life, but maybe now it's time to go big. Jesus knew what was in Zacchaeus' heart, and he knows what's in yours. When you're open to change, like Zacchaeus, when you're willing to make amends and live differently, then salvation will come to your home as well. And no giant could ever stand in your way then.